Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the inaugural session of the Rugby Room here at McMullen's Irish Pub in Denver, Colorado. We're here to talk about rugby and the business of rugby. And to my left, I've got Luke Gross, who's a USA Hall of Famer, Pete Borlase, and next to him, Pete and Luke are the current coaching team for the Colorado Raptors, the Major League Rugby side located here. And down at the far end of the table is the Colonel, Otis McGregor, who's here as our resident culture keeper to make sure we stay on track.
That's right, with all things American. All the funny talkers, we're going to balance things out. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the purpose of the Rugby Room is just to speak to our community about rugby and get some of our subject matter experts in here and share their knowledge and their experience and promote the game. So what I'd like to do, starting with you, Luke, just give us a little bit of your background and why rugby? What is it for you?
Born in Decatur, Indiana.
Yep.
Grew up playing basketball and American football. Went to university or college at
yep.
Marshall University in Huntington, West Virginia.
Yep.
And in grad school, picked up rugby. Rented out a big house on my own and subleased a bunch of rooms
yep.
and a bunch of rugby players rented them. One thing led to another. Made my way over to Europe after playing for the U.S. team.
Yeah.
Had a 13-year professional career over in Europe.
13 years?
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah, very lucky.
What age were you when you went?
I was 24 when I went.
Yeah.
Yeah. Three World Cups, very lucky. Didn't get to play in the last one because my old body had broken. But was
mate, you look like an athlete. Look at that body. What are you talking about?
Hey, easy. I'm married. But, yeah, very, very lucky career, and it's a path that kind of surprised me, right?
It, yeah.
Being a basketball player, born to rugby, it's kind of unique, right? And you
yeah.
pick up the game at 20, 22, 23, not knowing it. And I had some good coaches along the way that helped direct me. That was one of the reasons I had such a good career.
So what year did you land in Europe?
96. It was a year after it went professional in England.
So after the 95 was the World Cup that South
yeah.
Africa won.
Yeah.
And that hooked you in. You loved all that free Nelson Mandela stuff.
I didn't even know the World Cup was going on.
You landed in the wrong country, didn't you?
Yeah, exactly.
What about you, Pete? Tell us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, born and raised in Christchurch, New Zealand.
Yep.
Started playing rugby, you know, as most Kiwis do, five years old. Dad used to pack me up every Saturday morning, take me over to Preble Rugby Club and take me boots up and get out there at 9 a.m. on the frosty pitch.
Yep.
Through that, just went through the rugby system, Canterbury Country, went to Christchurch Boys High.
Yep.
So tell
the community a little bit about Canterbury, because they're quite a significant piece of global rugby.
Mm.
And so just promote Canterbury a little bit there.
Yeah, so I mean, the Canterbury catchment is actually made up of South Canterbury, Mid Canterbury, Canterbury itself. And pretty much it ties in from the country to town rugby, and then it filters up through high schools and the
yep.
like into the Canterbury Academy.
Yep.
And so that was kind of my pathway
yep.
through Preble Rugby Club in the country
yep.
onto high school, playing for Christchurch Boys High, then into the town club scene, and then
yep.
into Canterbury Rugby.
Nice one. And Canterbury, and I know you've been deliberately humble, Pete, mm. aren't you? They produce, roughly one-third of the All Blacks New Zealand squad every year, don't they?
Yeah. I mean, we'd, you know, you'd be looking at the Crusaders, and Canterbury would have a catchment of about 12, 14 All Blacks.
So that's arguably the highest standard of rugby in the world right now, if you look at generational All Blacks.
Yeah, I'm a wee bit biased, you know what I mean? I know
that's
six,
right.
Six
it's an open house.
Six Nations is on this weekend, but I was up watching the Waratahs Crusaders last night. I'm not going to shy there. But, no, I mean, they've got great systems in place, and everything funnels up, and, you know, even with regards to our coach and the like, I lean on them a lot.
Yeah.
And some stuff I take, some stuff I don't take, because, you know, when you've got 12, you know, a dozen All Blacks in the room. You know, standards go high, and sometimes you don't need
a little bit difficult to argue the toss on those points. Yeah. What about you, Otis? Your trajectory is slightly different.
I'm a late bloomer to rugby. Although I was recruited to play many times, throughout my military career.
Yeah.
I always turned it down because the guys would always try to recruit me on Monday morning after they played on Sunday.
Yeah.
And they'd have a black eye and their nose would be scratched up. And I'd be like, no, man, no way I'm playing this game. And then
not a marketing package.
No, it didn't work for me. No matter how much they told me how much fun it was and everything of that nature. And then my youngest son, we went to the World Cup in France in 2005.
Yeah.
So USA versus Samoa, and my youngest son fell in love with the game, and I was the dad who picked my son up from training every day, and I started to leave work earlier and earlier, and standing there a little bit longer, and then Peter and I were just talking about our common friend John. John was the coach at the time, and he called me over and said, "Who are you? What do you do? Why are you here?" sort of thing. We started talking, and he loved the fact that I was special force, because I was special forces, asked me to start doing the fitness training for the team. And that was put me on a path to be the head coach for about 7 years. And somewhere in there, you think Luke started late. I played my first match at 51. And I made the huge mistake of trying to play rugby like I coached high school boys to play rugby, and thought my heart was going to explode. next ruck, that worked about three rucks, and it was take a knee and rest for 10 minutes.
So
a little bit different path, and now I've stepped away from coaching, but still involved with the game in this sense, and with the Rugby Colorado Board.
Awesome. Well done. So, Pete, where did you go with your career from Canterbury as a player?
So, I mean, Canterbury, and then I was in the Crusaders squad. And speaking of All Blacks, at the time it was 22 men to a squad, to a match day squad. And there was Owen and Ben Franks and White Crockett.
Yeah.
And I was the fourth prop, and, three All Blacks. So I kind of got to a bit of a T-junction.
Yeah.
And decided to go to Europe rather than a rival club in New Zealand.
Yeah.
And so I decided to go north to Munster. Yeah.
Munster. Why Munster?
I've got Canterbury, red and black through my veins. It means a lot to me, that place. And it was actually, like I said, going to Otago or the like, or a rival team, just didn't sit well with me. And actually, it was talking to the Melbourne Rebels at the time, and a guy by the name of Greg Somerville was coming back from up north. So I'm like, well, again, I'm competing with All Blacks. So Munster was the natural fit for me at the time.
Yeah. And what position did you play?
Tight head and moonlighted as a loose head at times.
So tight head moonlighting as a loose head. In simple English, what does that mean? Explain to our audience.
So it means I should have been a loose head from the start, because halfway through my career I realized it was a lot easier than tight head. But tight head, obviously you've got a prop on the outside of you, and you've got the hooker. So you've got pressure coming from both sides.
Yeah.
A loose head, you're on the other side, so you've only got that one shoulder to work angles. So
yeah.
You should be getting through more work.
Got to dig into you a little bit there. So technicalities on props, a technical position in a game of rugby, in a 15s game.
Yeah.
So you're playing in the scrum.
Yeah.
So, and again, just bearing in mind that most of our consumer audience here are new to rugby.
Yeah.
So just maybe using the shot glasses.
Yep.
What does a scrum look like? What does it do? And where was your role in there?
Okay. So, this is called the tight five. This is the front row.
Yeah.
If we grab some more shot glasses, so we've got prop, hooker, prop, lock, blindside flanker, number eight, open side flanker.
Yeah.
So if this is a sideline, the tight head prop's job is to try work that right hand side up. And what happens is when he works that right hand side up, it takes their loose forward out of play, and as well as their number eight. So if we're to this sideline here, they've got a great opportunity to launch.
Yeah. So I was reading somewhere statistically when a scrum occurs, particularly at tier one. So you use the word rugby or footy.
What's that?
Are you a rugby or a footy? What do you call it?
I can go in and out of it. Yeah. Footy fine.
You look a bit of footy.
Yeah.
So when a scrum occurs, mm-hmm. In a tier one level of footy, I was reading something like about 1,000 pounds of pressure going through the necks and shoulders of those athletes. And that's significant for like, what, 30 to 60 seconds?
Yeah. I mean, that's probably why I'm sitting here and retired at 28. Because me gave away, yeah. Well, no, I'm 34. I retired at 28. Retired at 28. Thank you, though.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah, I mean, it's like in regards to our coaching, you know, 90% of scrums don't move.
Yeah.
So there's a ton of pressure, you know, from start to finish.
Yeah.
You know, set up is, you know, from the whistle being blown, I think you're looking at about, what, 40 seconds?
Yeah.
45 seconds start to finish?
Yeah. And how is an athlete, because the game's dynamic, there's a lot of offense, defense occurring.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to prepare for that part of the game, knowing full well that in any given game you might have 20, 30 scrums.
Mm-hmm.
So as an athlete, how do you prepare for that?
Tell the backs to catch the ball. Give us a break every now and then. No, I mean, it's obviously...
Yeah, but law of averages, come on.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You know, it's just always dependent on the opposition that you're playing, you know, whether, you know, obviously, you know, we speak of, you know, Canterbury versus Munster, obviously the style of play in the Northern Hemisphere is a lot more of an arm wrestle type game. So, yeah, I mean, it's all part of your preparation and your week going in, you know, unless there's, you know, a rainstorm come through or the like, or, you know, just bad handling, you know what you're sort of getting yourself in for scrum wise.
So is it all gym work?
What's that, sorry?
Is it all gym work, weight training? You got quite a significant pair of shoulders on you. You have a pretty big coat hanger for that shirt.
Mate, so. I'm carrying him, mate. No. I mean, one thing is, you know, you can have the best squat in the gym and the like, but it doesn't necessarily translate to a scrum. You know, a ton of fitness needed for a scrum and a ton of technique.
Yeah.
Technique always wins. Obviously, if you've got fitness, technique, as well as good strength, you know, you're in a good position.
Yeah.
So one of the things I love about rugby is the fact that it's going nonstop, and then all of a sudden, bam, it stops, and you've got to change your mindset for this one event in a set piece sort of way, and particularly in a scrum, like you were just, you know, were just touching on, is the technicalities and the mindset and then the fitness of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious, when that whistle blows, referee gives the signal that it's a scrum, what did you do? Was there a mental switch? Was there a disruption? Did you use any sort of technique to get your mind into that set?
Well, I mean, first thing I would do is clear my studs. That was always my first part of my process, but, you know, like Angus mentioned, you know, a lot of people look at scrums as, you know, 8 to 12 seconds or the like, but as soon as that whistle blows, especially as a front rower, you've got to be getting into that mindset of your process, your setup, you know, getting with your hooker, taking that space, you know, transfer, you know, being able to transfer that power across. So, yeah, for sure, mentally I'd take a deep breath and, you know, depending on where you are in the field, you know where the pressure is going to be coming and the like, or, you know, if you're on the sideline, they're going to try pressure you across. Obviously, if you're 5 meters from your line, you know, they're going to be coming hard at you.
Yeah, and I think, go ahead, Luke.
As a second row behind him, want him to know that I'm there, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm his power, his engine. So I give him a slap on the butt as I get in there and bind in, so he knows I'm with him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a teamwork thing. That's a huge part of it. And to go back to a tight head, this is why they make so much money. It's because it's physically the most difficult position on the field. If you have a good tight head, you have a good scrum, you know, 90% of the time. And I think you made bank on that.
Yeah. What's that? Because sometimes you can be the first to come in and then you can be the first out the door.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. It's pretty impressive. I've had the... great honor to play against some very good, or behind some very good tight heads, you know, like guys like Jason Leonard, guys like that. they're just, something's wrong. Something's always wrong upstairs with those guys. They're always a bit crazy.
And I like that. I like that pressure
squeezing their head.
Yeah.
And as Lukey said, coming forward to the prop and saying, I've got you, that's great, because then he's got his fingerprints on the scrum if it goes back as well.
always full.
Always.
So a couple of questions for you then, actually, because I know the front row is a bit of a union. Mm. Talk about the dark arts.
Yeah.
Right, but you're out in the plane, so in terms of dark arts in the front row, what would you like to share? Give us one thing you get up to in there.
Mate, I mean,
without breaking the union, I'm sure it's not going to
happen. Yeah, it's community.
I know, I just spoke about that.
I don't want to be thrown out of the club. I mean, it's forever changing, you know what I mean? It's the game's evolving so much that, like, I mean, even, you know, 10 years ago, like I said, it was 22 match day squad, and you'd be the third prop on the bench going, well, am I coming on to tight head? Am I coming on to loose head? Who's switching over? So a lot more taxing there to, you know, even the cadence call, you know what I mean? Where you could load up as a tight head, you know, crouch, bind, engage, you know.
Yeah.
Forever changing, so you could crank guys down. Now it's, you know, crikey, I think I'd still be playing if I had this nice roll in. I don't know. There's two, there's two on the bench and the light.
I mean, for me,
I always went by the ground as your friend.
Yep.
So if someone gets you on engagement, take it straight to ground. Because otherwise you're going over your lock. And I think, you know, if it goes down, the fans can't see you going over your lock, you know.
Right. Yeah. Which is a bit embarrassing on camera.
That's it. Yeah, there's nowhere to hide up there.
So last on, then we're going to pick on Luke for a bit. So in the modern game or in the history of rugby, which prop would you have loved to scrum against out of pure respect, and which prop would you have hated to scrum against out of pure fear?
I mean, to be honest, like Tony Woodcock, White, Crockett were handfuls to prop against.
Both All Blacks. Canterbury products.
Tony Woodcock was the Blues and North Harbour. But to be honest, mate, going to France and playing over there with, you know, some guys that you haven't even heard of, Romanian or the like, playing for La Rochelle.
Yeah.
I mean, you wouldn't even. I can't even remember his name, but I know he sent me through my locks a couple of times. So it's like, you know, any dog on his day.
Yeah.
And probably, to be honest, at the higher level, it's the guys who have all the attributes, that's why they're in there.
Yeah.
Where you go to Europe, and not sort of touching too much on the Europe game, you have some guys that's their role, is just to disrupt scrum and be a nuisance and line out a maul.
Yeah.
They may miss six tackles, but by crikey, they'll... Would
they be like the enforcer in rugby? Or not rugby, I'm sorry, hockey. You know, hockey it's kind of drifted away from it in a little bit more modern hockey, but each team always had this enforcer. It was the guy that, you know, if you messed with the star on that team, he was coming to see you, you know, after the next whistle. Mm.
A lot of the French teams would have one guy that didn't travel. Because if he traveled, he would be beat up by the crowd or whatever. Because he was the guy that would be the enforcer, so to say. And now that the modern game has changed a bit from that.
Were you an enforcer? Yeah.
No, not at all. I was a lover.
So switching gears then, played three World Cups, USA Hall of Famer. Where do you want to go with that? Do you want to talk about being in the Hall of Fame or the World Cups?
Let's go to the World Cup. So let's stay away from the Hall of Fame.
So which three?
99, 03, and 07. And like I said, the 07, my body broke as we were getting ready for England.
So 99 was UK, was it?
Yes, yeah. It was Wales mainly. Yeah, we were
UK.
Yeah, I know that. we were based in the Ireland for our bracket. Yeah, 99. Okay.
And then 2003 was where?
Australia.
Yeah,
that was
a good one.
And then 07 was France.
Right.
Then I did see you play.
Yeah.
I did see you play. That was the first time we met.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll talk about that on camera.
Yeah.
So let's get Otis's opinion of you. Which World Cup?
It was the 2007 World Cup.
I didn't get a play.
Oh, I thought you did play.
Yeah, no, my body broke.
So, old
man at that stage. I was the oldest guy in the World Cup. So,
how old were you?
38.
Not
37.
Quite 51. He's still
close, 51. Though. Close.
Yeah. I'm still looking at 2023. You know, I'm still.
So which one of those World Cups would you like to speak to?
The 03 one. Yeah.
So how did you prep for that in terms of mental, physical preparation? You were playing in Europe at the time?
At the time I was playing in Europe.
Yeah.
Where was I? Club-wise, I just left the Harlequins, and I think I was up in Newcastle, or just signed with Newcastle up in the north of England.
So Harlequins is a London team, and Newcastle is northeast of England.
Yeah. The U.S., we had a camp back here that lasted for a month. We were all based in Boulder, Colorado, training at the University of Colorado.
Yeah.
We had guys in and out because we had a bunch of guys that were working.
Yeah.
You know, so it was tough at times to get everybody together and stuff. But the prep overall was really good. I was very lucky because I was in a full-time environment where a lot of our guys weren't.
Yeah.
So what was it, Luke? Was it about 50-50 at that point, professional and amateur?
No, the 03, it was more like a third of us playing professionally. A lot of the guys were, working 9-to-5s and actually taking time off work to come and train with this and stuff like that. It's pretty tough on the domestic-based guys, you know, especially the guys with families or careers that they had to put on hold.
Yeah.
But overall, it was a good World Cup for us.
Yeah.
The prep was good, and it was the beginning of those longer prep camps for the U.S., and they've been building on them ever since. And I think this year they had a total of, 6 weeks together before the World Cup, if you remember?
Yeah.
Yeah, because they were in and out of...
It started in June. I thought it started in June, the initial camp.
They were in for a couple of weeks, and they went to the Springs, and then they went up to Canada.
Yeah. I took them up in the mountains for
Did
3 days.
Yeah, the boys?
Yeah.
So I took an old school military thing.
Yeah. Everyone came home. That's good.
Yeah.
So, what did you like about the 2003 World Cups? It's down in Oz.
Yeah. Number one, you're in Oz.
What are your most significant playing memories down there?
Wow, some of them I blocked out.
Can't be off field.
Yeah, it can't be off field.
Playing memories only. Don't need to know any of the other stuff.
We didn't perform as well as you always hope, right? Yeah. But you're going against full professional. No excuses, ever in excuses. You're going against full professional teams, and the gap's quite wide
at
that stage.
Yeah.
But probably the best memory was playing against the French team. You know, now they beat us. They ran away from us a little bit at the end. But the physicality of the match, and that was always my game, the physicality part of it. And I always look at team first, but I'm going to talk about personally. And I felt against the French team, had a pretty good match personally.
Yeah.
Team-wise, we didn't have a great one.
Where did you excel?
Myself?
Yeah.
In the physicality part of it. Definitely.
Right. What does that mean for our consumers here? Is that like going out there like a boxer and knocking people out?
No, never. You have to stay within the rules of the game. And I never went out to hurt anybody, ever. Yeah. Now, bruises, stitches, that's part of the game.
Yeah,
that's all right.
Absolutely.
You didn't go out to get caught.
Oh, listen to that. Listen, those what takes one to know it. Just to dominate a ruck when you hit it, be with my prop when I'm with him. You know, the second rows game has... From 2003 to where it is now is completely different. In 2003, you were more of a supporting role. I'm a ball winner at the ruck. I'm a ball winner at kickoffs. I'm a ball winner. Yeah,
jumper.
Line out jumper. All that. You know, you're that ball winner. You're not necessarily the guy with the ball in hand dancing around. But I felt.
How tall are you?
Now? I'm only 6'7" now.
What were you back then?
Shrinking up. About 6'9" and a half or so.
Yeah. Wow. That's pretty high.
Yeah, it was a big lump, but part of the game.
Talk about that. You've got the game within the game, right? So we talk about front row contest on the game within the game. When you look at your locks, you say like rucking and counter rucking and winning possession at the lineouts. So if you're stepping up to a lineout and you're seeing, right, I've got to jump against this guy and beat them. Again, who did you know? Because you've got a basketball background.
Yeah.
Did you walk up and go, I'm going to out-jump every guy, every sucker, and every line out? Did you have that feeling you could do that? Or
You had to. You had to have that feeling, right? Because you're there to win the ball.
Right.
Basketball really helped me because it's all about positioning, right?
Yeah.
So when you're in the modern game, they're lifting or active support. It's about when you jump, it's how to manipulate your body to get in front to win that ball, both defensively and in attack, right?
Yeah.
Especially when you're under so much pressure. It's not very often in that World Cup that you got clean lineouts. You know, it was always a battle. You know, and the modern game, there's so much more movement, and so and now I attribute it to like a dance nowadays. Back then, it was more of a brawl. I'd have to say.
You're making your decisions early on the way in, and you just want to get in and out and restart fast. Yeah. Whereas back then, that might be a little bit of a fight in the air.
Yeah, just a little bit. Yeah, yeah.
So I always find it interesting, and as a semi-outsider to the game, because I keep hearing it thrown around whenever I'm in a rugby community, the modern game. When did it become the modern game? Was it because back when you were playing, it was hard, and that was the old game, and now all these young whippersnappers got it easy, or what?
I go back and I watch the 80s. Have you ever, it's online, you can find the 80s rugby games.
Yeah.
That was hard rugby. Oh, my God. Mm. They're binding up before they even come into a ruck, and they smash it.
The only compliment I need today.
You know, the men today, and Pete can speak on this too, the guys today are a lot bigger and stronger and all that, and there's so much more force, and because it's a study, right? The scrum is, and we'll just use the scrum as an example, the angles and the positioning and all that are so much more technical, where back then it was like we're binding up and you're smashing in on the way in that into that scrum, you're hitting a head off of someone else's head, and, you know, those guys back then were, I think, physically a lot more, or more mentally they were a lot stronger, you know. Not saying our guys today aren't mentally strong, but
I think it's, you know, the evolution of the game is interesting, because I can remember going to Lancaster Park in the, you know, in the early 90s, or, you know,
where's Lancaster Park?
That was what, Jade Stadium in Christchurch, so home of Canterbury. And you'd go back behind the number one, and you'd hear the lads in there, and, you know, the odd cigarette smoke coming out and the like. Yeah. And then it kind of went into, you know, the late 90s, and then, you know, the turn. And, you know, even when I was playing in around, you know, 2007, you know, moving forward, 2006, moving forward, you know, we thought we had everything ironed out with regards to nutrition and the like, but, you know, now these days you go back and you know, you look at fellas and there's guys drinking water after a game.
Yeah.
You know, everyone's so dialed in and everyone's just looking for that edge.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, nutrition and everything top to bottom all the way down. It's really interesting.
So we've actually got a question from the UK. You happy to field that?
Oh, no.
So from James Allen in Marlow in the UK, his question is, can you replicate English or UK rugby club culture here in the US? Mm. By that, I'm sure he means New Zealand as well. Because you're all pommies at heart.
I think you can replicate. It's always going to take its own flavor because you're here in the US. But I know in the UK, sports are more club oriented.
Yeah,
not all your schools have them, but it's more of a focus on club. Over here, schools have the sports.
Yeah,
and so it's a little bit of a different approach.
Yeah,
I think, but you can have a club, definitely.
It's really interesting, and it's a good question, because when I got here 7 years ago, I was just coming from, you know, New Zealand, Ireland, and the like, where you're just so used to having everything. Your club rooms, you know, Mary in the kitchen cooking up the after-match function and the like. When I landed here and I went to my first club game, you know, and you're changing out the back of a car or the like, and then you go to like a San Francisco Golden Gate, and it's like, wow, these guys have club rooms, you know.
Yeah.
And then you go to like an Austin Blacks.
Yeah.
These guys have a club room. It's like, you know, you go to Santa Monica, crikey, you don't actually think as a foreigner, you're like, where's the club rooms? Well, I mean, what does it cost for land and, you know, A for a pitch and B for a clubhouse and, you know, LA, you know? So it's like, you've got to look at the perimeters. So, you know, if you're in Des Moines, Iowa, you know, or Iowa Falls, Iowa, you know, maybe you can have a clubhouse on some land because it's affordable. In Denver, I don't know, maybe it is just renting the field or the like and then coming back to a McMullins for a pint.
It's quite an interesting challenge, because if you look at the average age of a World Cup winning team or a Tier 1 team that's fully professional, you know, you've got to have that bridge from club to college to full-time professional. And so how do you do that? And this may be coming out through an MLR lens, because you're both in the MLR. How do you bridge that experience, that lack of growth, that lack of development without the club game?
Well, to be honest, I mean, without going too deep into it, it's just my opinion. You know, you've got to have that feeder coming up rather than, you know, hanging at the top and trying to pull up. Takes a lot of time. I mean, as you know, in regards to preparing for the MLR season, you're so focused on recruiting and the like, you actually need, you know, you need funding for personnel, you know, female or male, in place, connecting that pathway all the way up. And I think it's about getting, you know, people 10 years of under, rugby balls in their hands and schools and the like, and then feeding them up and having a connection. Again, I think coming back to the original question was, it's tough because you're trying to connect, you know, Mark or Sue to the game, but you're saying, hey, come down to the pub or the like, you know, where in New Zealand you've got a rugby club rooms where the kids are naturally playing on the field.
Family community.
It is. So again, it's got to be organic, and you've got to, try pull it through one way or another.
Yeah.
But, you know, in Europe, you know, soccer is the same way.
Yeah.
And, you know, having lived in Germany and my kids playing in the clubs and seeing that whole thing, you know, right up to that edge of professional, and then, you know, stepping into the Premier. But the problem is, really, and I don't know if I'd say it's not a problem, but it's the way our sports culture has grown up, like you were talking about, Luke. We're in the schools. Our sports revolves around schools, both at the grade level and at the university level.
Yeah.
And I think that's where it has to grow. I mean, part of the love of rugby that we all love is the clubhouse feel and that camaraderie. But how do we bring that into the schools? Because when you look at other sports, at school age sports, how the community comes around that sport and that high school, and they come out. It's not just the parents. I mean, especially, you know, if you go back to football in Texas where I grew up, and how, you know, the Friday Night Lights, the big movie, and you know, about West Texas and out in Odessa, and how that was the entire community supported that team every Friday night, which is the same as what rugby is with the club overseas. But how do we develop that sort of camaraderie in the school system to grow the game that way? I think that's where the foundation has to be.
To be honest, I think it's a generational thing as well. You know, like I've got two boys, you know, players I coach, you know, Arta Malifa's got a son, you know, there is, I believe, an expat generation that's going to be coming through. But I think, to your point, we've got to tap into the 10 years and younger and try and make them a part of something and have them brought in. Again, there's, you know, it does take time, takes financials and the like.
For someone like yourself, Pete, so for someone like you, Luke, you here, this is home.
Yeah.
So you that's, in terms of time investment, you're a lifer. Right, and you're putting back into the game. But for you, that's a commitment to stay in the US and commit to growing rugby, the sport you love, in the US.
So
that's mentally and emotionally, that's a dislocation from the motherland that you've got to be willing to take part in.
Mate, my wife's American. I'm, you know, both my sons are Kiwi American, so I'll
culture test.
So I mean, I'm in here for the long haul. You know, when I turned up 7 years ago, again, just understanding the landscape of American rugby.
Yeah.
Within the first 6 months, I remember us being in Tampa. You know.
Yeah.
And we're with the USA under 20s and. Again, you know, you give up your day job for a week or so to go out and work with the boys, don't you?
Yeah.
And you just do it for the love of it, you know? And it brought me back to that, you know, club feeling in New Zealand.
Yeah.
But then you actually realise with the lads, you know, you've only got a catchment of a certain amount of players that can actually afford it, or mum and dad are actually paying out the cash, you know? You know, Mark or Bob or whatever in the inner city of LA may not be able to pony up $400 to get to Tampa.
Yeah.
So,
so we've really got to work hard on the business side of things. If we want to build our backfield process, pipelines, club culture, whatever that looks like, and as you say, with an American flavor, the off-field business operations, I think, are pretty weak, to be honest. How do you feel about that, Luke? Because you've been, where did you go? I knew you were at Harlequins in London, then you were at Newcastle. yeah, right? Both well-funded organisations.
Caneffley in Wales.
Caneffley in Wales. Then, never mind.
Yorkshire was in...
Is that a part of a sentence? Did you do something wrong?
Caneffley?
They sent you to Wales.
Done to Wales.
Did you upset?
Caneffley actually was one of my favourite clubs.
Yeah.
It was absolutely incredible. It was a very much a player-led place. You know,
but again, their infrastructure is massive.
Everything is right there, yeah. They have youth programs, women's teams, amateur men's teams. You know, everything's right there on site.
So those are three. I mean, Newcastle is funded in part by Sir John Hall, so that's a bit of sugar daddy money coming out of the soccer environment. Yeah, the Harlequins got like 150 plus history and a treasure chest that's huge, and an acre of land just outside of Twickenham, you know, all white collar funding from two or three generations in Caneffley, as you say, it's a cornerstone of Welsh rugby. So how would you, looking at that and having experienced that, how do you think some of that could be replicated over here?
It does. It goes back to the schools, right? You get it in the schools, and then clubs can develop in the off seasons of the school seasons.
Yeah.
You know, maybe as all-star teams or something like that. But there are clubs around that are like Golden Gate, like Austin, and actually Glendale.
Yeah.
Or not? Yeah, Glendale Rugby Club. You know, where the home of the Colorado Raptors. That's another club that has a youth program, women's teams, amateur men's teams.
Yeah.
You know, it can be replicated, but it's just going to take time. And I think it does go back to the schools. You've got to get kids playing at schools and then use the clubs like all-star.
So we're lucky in Colorado. And we've got now first generation of rugby players whose first sport is rugby, and which is a massive cultural shift. But that's talking about standing on the shoulders of giants, because before I came in, there's people like Otis and people around who spent 10 years or more building that in. So that's sort of a cultural time shift. That's a major investment in people's lives.
Yeah.
And so it takes a lot of packaging, I think, from all of us to get involved.
Well, there's plenty of models to do the combination, right? Because and when you step away from football is its own beast in itself. But if you look at the other sports that have really become big in the U.S. in the high schools, between volleyball, soccer, even basketball, the kids will play for their school, and then they'll play for a club also. Yeah. And I think that's the real growth of the game. But it boils down to growing the population. And the only way you grow the population, to go back to the business of it, is the marketing aspect. How do I sell? How do I get that kid that's 8 years old, that's 9 years old, that wants to come out and play and continue to play? And that's the catch, is how do I get it from, because almost all the players that played for me when I was coaching high school, about 50% of my team each year were seniors. Mm-hmm. They finished playing football for their entire life. And they wanted to try it. They knew they weren't going to play football in college, and they'd heard about rugby, and they came out and give it a run. So half my team every year was a first-year, first-season play. And that always made it difficult. Because,
that's a normal story.
Yeah.
That's a lot of America.
That's the way you got introduced to the game, right?
Yeah.
But like Angus said, I think the great thing, I mean, the thing that we as a rugby nation should celebrate is the fact that Look at how we've grown the game at the young level, the little kid, the rookie level, and now we're getting more and more of these players that are starting at the young age and going through. I mean, I think of Ben Pinkelman and Cody Melfi. Angus and I were talking about them. They're playing on the USA Sevens team in Sydney right now together. Two boys that grew up here in Denver, and both of them started playing. I think Ben as a freshman in high school. I think Cody about the same time.
So yeah,
that's a huge victory in my book.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to pivot around slightly. We just got a few more minutes left before you guys have to head out to your family duties, which is a nice segue. So you both, and your life is you man and boy in front of the mask kind of things, playing rugby, growing up with rugby. You've both moved your lives around the world for rugby. Mm-hmm. And now you've transitioned from players to coaches, reinvesting back in their game. And I know you've both done it on an amateur level, and now you're doing it on a professional level. So a couple of questions here. And tag team how you like, answer how you like. Number one, how do you manage your family with all that? That's a lot of mileage. And number two, now you've reinvested back in as professional coaches. Where would you like to see Major League Rugby or the Colorado Raptors in the next 3 to 5 years? So family or profession, where do you want to go?
I'll start with the family one.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, family-wise, marry a rugby girl. She understands. That's
where
the easiest.
She's in the room here.
She's
somewhere.
Right behind you with my daughter, actually.
With a knife, yeah. To plunge it into. Oh, here we go.
Yeah, here we go.
Look at that. He Hi, is a family baby. Man. This isn't Hi, staged, baby. By the way. This is real.
Can you wave?
This is your own children.
Yeah, this is actually my own daughter. Can't you tell by the ears?
It's the hair, mate.
It's the hair. You okay, sweetie?
So this must present challenges.
Yeah,
but
it
you're
does.
A sane family man. Today?
It's a balance, right? And it's not always perfect, yeah? Because we do travel every weekend, starting next weekend for, what, 5 weekends in a row we're gone or at home and we're very busy. You know, you're putting in film work at night. So you have to pick, right? It's like, I'll do my work at this time, but right here, this 2 hours after dinner to bedtime is kids' time, right?
And this is a real job.
Yeah, this is a real job.
You've got a balanced job with family life like everyone else in every
other
profession.
But it's not a 9 to 5, right? For Pete, it's 6:30 to 6:30.
What's your standard day look like?
I'd be in the office for 6 and out the gate for maybe 5. Anywhere between 5 and 6:30. In the off season or in the preseason, start of preseason would be maybe 7 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
So big days, and I mean I've got a son who's coming up 2 years, and my second son's 7 months. So it's pretty tough. You can go a few days in a row with waking up and they're still asleep, and getting home and they're in bed. So.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Lukey's been around the block as well, and I've been around the block, and you just understand that to win and to get something special at the end of it that only the group knows about.
Got to put the hours in.
You got to graft, man. Yeah. Doesn't matter if you're a builder, a plumber, a lawyer.
Yeah.
To get the results, you got to put the hours in.
And that's quite a nice parallel, because I think there's still a little bit of mythology out there that professional sports is a cushy life, you know. I want to go and play a bit of footy because it's better than being a plumber.
To be honest, I remember running around on the training pitch as a player, aching bones, sore back, about to go hit the scrum machine or live scrum.
Yeah.
Turn around and be like, crikey, I want to be a coach.
Wish I was a plumber.
No, I wanted to be the coach because I thought it was easy as hell. And now coaching, I'm like, crikey, this thing doesn't stop.
Yeah. You know? You're a damn player again, right?
Yeah, I wish I was back on the
team. Human resource management under pressure, really.
Yeah. Yeah, you've got to get that balance. Like Lukey said, you know, you've got to make time for the family. You've got to make sure the minutes count with the boys and the wife and the like to keep her sane. And, Lukey's wife has obviously got a background in rugby. My wife doesn't, so holding her hand through it a little bit. And you know,
you're a good man.
That's it.
I'm not one of those.
Yeah.
No, she's a good lady.
Hey, if I've got a pint in front of her, she's happy, you know.
Do you purposefully do it, or do you do it by chance? And what I mean is, if you're working in preparation during mid-season, and you have all this time that you're spending with the team, do you set aside, is there a time, like, and I can't remember the coach I was listening to the other day, but he was talking about his weekly schedule during the season, and how he shuts down on Friday afternoons. I think it was an NFL coach. He shuts down Friday afternoons, and that's when he goes home. But Friday afternoon for him is like 3:30, 4 o'clock, not noon.
No.
So I'm just kind of curious.
Well, I mean, at the same time, there's always curveballs and things coming up. All of a sudden, someone gets an injury or someone tears a pec.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to go to the well. You know, you've got to look into things. I mean, I said to my wife the other day, you know, she was sort of talking about the hours and the hours that we put in, and I turned around and said, you know, there's NFL coaches that sleep in their office, and she goes, well, you know, I'd like to see their salaries versus yours. But, you know, I mean, ultimately, you're just trying to grind.
Hey, you're the highest paid prop in the world.
Yeah,
mate. Made bank already on the plane.
Right.
They need a salary.
There you go.
I'm about to ask Lukey for a loan, mate. He's a year longer than I am.
Okay, so close out. Actually, no, MLR and the Raptors. Where would you like to see that in the next 3 to 5 years? So regulatory, finance, everything, no barriers. In your mind's eye, what would that look like? Dream vision.
3 years?
You could do five.
Four and a half if you want
for 5 years.
He's been around so long. 3 years is like tomorrow morning.
Listen to you. It'd be good to see us on the same path that we're going, but continually improving, right? Because 5 years really for a professional league, if you look through Europe, 5 years is not that big of a, or long of a time frame, right?
Yeah.
But as long as we're continually improving, not only as a club, but as a league, that's where I'd like to see it. Just constantly getting better.
Simple, sustainable growth. Fine-tune.
Yep.
Too many outrageous decisions.
Exactly.
I would sort of expand on that a little bit, and I'd like to see them maybe taper towards the top league model in Japan without going too deep. I think now that the systems are in place, maybe we look at maybe not trying to drop a gear and speed on too much, and actually take a minute to breathe and let the game grow.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of teams going off in different directions. I think if we take a long breath,
just a bit of stability is.
Yeah.
It's grown rapidly in size.
Yeah.
It's just gone from bam, bam, bam like that. Into
I mean,
16 teams now.
Yeah. Which I really worry because we've drained all our domestic players, right?
Yeah.
That we don't have the quality. And this is nothing against anybody. Yeah, we're improving, but I'm not me as a rugby player when I picked it up at 24 is not the answer, or him.
Yeah.
It's not. We've kind of drained all our pools,
yeah,
and now we're relying on
overseas.
Yeah, and they've upped the numbers, which is okay.
Yeah.
But we've also started. I mean, we're gonna damage what one of the goals of the MLR was to help develop domestic players.
Yeah, we've got to keep an eye on that.
That's something. You know,
and I cut off your thought. I'm sorry. Finish it.
Yeah, sorry, Pete.
No. You're good. Sorry, I was thinking of other teams that are joining the MLR and trying to.
I'm thinking about
next Saturday against Houston and certain things. But just to expand on that, and I think I've said to you in the past, Angus, I don't want this league to become Curry Cup off season.
Yeah.
Or Mitre 10 off season.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, yes, there's a place for players to come in and add. They've got to add to the environment.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it's...
Owners, pay attention. Heard it here.
It's 2023, you know. It's the World Cup in 2023.
Yeah.
And in regards to our players and all our recruits, there was one player in speaking to that brought up the 2023 World Cup, and that was actually... You know, before looking at more of his footage, that's what signed him up to our club.
And we need homegrown players in a top tier comp if we want to compete and be effective in the 23 World Cup. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right, guys, I'm going to bring it to a close. Quick fire, all three of you. Right. About 30, 40 second quick fire questions. Right. Just see where you're at. So, first question, favorite Northern Hemisphere club side and why?
Canethly.
Why?
Because I played there and it was a great time.
Because of your home legacy.
Munster.
Why?
The people, the fans, the province in itself.
Yeah.
Glasgow Warriors.
Why?
Heritage. My heritage is part of it.
Tom, you need to step out, mate.
Tom.
We're still on the go live. Favorite Southern Hemisphere club side and why?
Go ahead.
He's at the edge of his knowledge.
Where?
Crusaders.
Yeah. Right, and because it's home.
Oh, they beat the Waratahs last night, so back the
winners. It's always a good thing.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, you have to go home. I say the Crusaders too, just because of where I learned my rugby.
Next point's on me.
Yeah.
Southern Hemisphere is the other side of the planet, mate.
You're getting 3 points to Crusaders.
Crusaders all around.
I think Guinness is here.
Favorite position on the field, and why?
I like number six.
Why?
Because you're not stuck in the scrum. You can get out and run a little bit, and it puts you in a good position to receive the ball and attack, and you can just be a big brute against backs. Kind of like that.
Like to bully the little ones.
Yeah, always. Right. Good.
Yeah, mine would be number 8.
Yeah.
Just because I was always stuck up front, and sometimes I'd come around the corner and the 9s wouldn't even give me the ball because I had a low number on me. So, yeah, I think. And used the year I've been an 8.
Props are sensitive, aren't you?
We are deep down somewhere.
and I'm an 8 man too because I just love that pivot position that you have as an 8 man where you're still in the power pack.
Yeah.
But you have responsibilities with the back. You're that transition player, and you get to play in both areas. That's why I really love the 8-man.
Okay. And favorite international player?
John Eel.
John Eels?
Yeah. He's back from the old day, right?
From Australia.
He's a second row who could do it all.
Yeah.
Really admire him as a player.
He had skills and brute.
Yep. Both.
Cool. Pete?
Be Todd Blackadder.
Todd Blackadder?
Yeah.
Why?
Again, a Canterbury man, come through, coached Tasman Marcos, and then worked his way into the Crusader setup. And just a lot of respect for the guy.
Otis?
Richie McGaw. Because here's a normal.
You've alienated a lot of people out in the world.
That's okay. I've done that all my life. But the leadership factors that he's a guy, if you passed him on the street and you weren't a Kiwi, you wouldn't know who he is.
Yeah.
And he's humble. And he has great leadership and great work ethic, and I admire that.
Okay, last three questions. Favorite U.S. 15s player on the circuit right now?
Wow, that's a tough one.
Could be in the national team or MLR upcomer.
Dylan Fawcett.
Dylan Fawcett?
Yeah.
Plays for Rooney in New York?
Yep.
Yep. Otis?
I like Cam Dolan. I mean, I got to know Cam a lot when I did the camp with him. I really enjoyed his attitude. He's got that, and he's an 8 man, so I mean, he's got that going for him too.
Come on, Luke, come in.
I'll go with Cam Dolan also. I was his coach on his way up. Just a tremendous young man, both on and off the field.
Okay, this tough one. Favorite sevens player on the U.S. circuit right now, male or female?
The Colorado kid we were just talking about.
Oh, you got a name in one of them. You can't
Pinkelman,
find a friend again.
Pinkelman.
Ben Pinkelman.
Yeah, because he's once again, he's homegrown. He's a great kid. And I also had coached him at the U20 level.
There's a theme coming here.
Yeah.
Luke's just had his hand in all the top circuit players.
Just a really good kid. And his work rate is tremendous.
Yeah.
Absolutely tremendous.
Pete, you're allowed to hate sevens. It's okay.
Yeah, not a fan. Right, not a fan. Okay, is there even going on at the moment?
Sevens or snap?
Yeah.
Otis.
It's Binky. Yeah, I mean, Ben, when I watch Ben play, and I've had Ben on my podcast too, and get into a little bit of his leadership style and philosophy, I think he's got a lot of great potential. Matter of fact, he's captaining this weekend.
Is he? Oh, good for him.
I will chime in and echo that. Ben Pinkelman being a Denver Barbarians player.
Good character, isn't he?
The guy's so relaxed and casual going about his work, and then got the heart of a lion, and
I mean,
15s or 17s, he could play both.
Last question, the Raptors notwithstanding, obviously, who's going to win, but it's not fair. Who's going to be in the final of this year's MLR?
No comment here.
So you're allowed to name three teams. The Raptors, yes. Okay.
Yeah, yep. So obviously the Raptors.
Which other two teams are top contenders?
This is a layered question, huh?
Can we come back on this in a couple of weeks?
I'll let you get our jail card. Who's going to win the Six Nations?
Wales.
Well, man, I used to like you. We had a romance once.
Ireland.
Ireland.
As much as I hate to say it, England.
What's wrong with the pubs? Come on. All right, and then who's going to win the next World Cup? Get your bets in now.
I don't want to say.
Come
no
on,
comment.
There's long odds no comment. Right now.
No, no comment.
Oh, come on.
Leave for that one.
Mate, you're not putting money on it.
No, I know.
I think England or New Zealand.
Yeah.
I think England will keep building.
Yeah. I just has to say the Eagles.
Yeah, I mean, I know. like I said with England, the numbers, I can't say the Eagles. A dark horse. I'll throw out a dark horse. I'm going to say France.
France.
Got a lot of young players going in the Six Nations this year.
Yeah.
I'm thinking there's some potential there with France. It's dark horse.
So thank you for being supporting the Rugby Roots.
Cheers, bud.
First outing. And good luck to the Colorado Raptors in the Major League Rugby 2020 season. Big shout out to the Irish pub. Mick Mullins here. Come down. The Guinness is good, even though they're not drinking it. Apparently, they're on a diet. and obviously, Ted, the tech guy, he's done a cracking job putting this together. But February the 8th is our next showing back here.